Hello, Dads. This is Jonathan. I'm back again with the Dad Corp podcast. I have with me host of Juice with Milan. Milan, say hi.
Hi, we're having a blast here.
We are here to kick off this week's episode of the Dad Corp podcast with a special guest and an old friend of mine, Spencer Colbert. We had an amazing conversation. We even gave him the rapid fire with Milan. Milan, did you have a good time?
I have a great time.
And before we get started, let me just give you a couple updates of what's going on at the Dad Corp since we have new things coming out to you on a daily basis. So check us out, www.thedadcorp.com. We have an amazing e-commerce site. While you're there, pick up one of our Dad Life shirts. It is going off the virtual shelves. We've recently scaled our operation to make sure we get you all your orders quickly. And if there's anything better that you'll find in our website and our podcast and the content, it will be our customer service. On top of that, check us out on Facebook. We have over 80,000 followers. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, LinkedIn. We're there. Subscribe to this podcast. We're on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcast. If there's a podcast out there, we're there. Let us know if there's something we're missing. We love the feedback. On top of that, make sure you check out our recent video podcast, Juices with Milan. Milan, what do you want to say about Juice with Milan?
Juice with Milan is great. My father's here and I'm here and it's a blast, you know? And the shirts are going to be beautiful. Don't worry. We're still thinking on it.
And so check out Juice with Milan. It is a 10-minute video podcast, current events, things to think about that she's dealing with as a six-year-old and a kid. Your kids are going to love it. She also gives the dad's advice. There's a little bit of a music session. There's a little bit of a culture section. And you'll come away knowing how to make your kids happy and what not to do to make your kids sad. So check us out. Awesome show. Lots of fun. Great family activity. Now, kicking off the show with Spencer Colbert, let me give you a quick rundown of his achievements. Spencer's currently the vice president of a lead generation business, Revenue Connect. He's a friend of mine. He has a great background and story. He grew up in the Washington, D.C. area where he spent most of his life. He currently resides in South Florida. He is dad fit and recently participated in his first bodybuilding competition where he placed second. He's a large man, 6'2", 270 pounds. The only thing bigger is his heart and his mind. He's got a beautiful family, three kids, 14, 7, 5. And on top of that, Spencer actually quit school at 16 years old, went back, got his GED, graduated from Howard University. He has lived on the couches of his friends, been a celebrity security guard, and he has worked his way to the top of corporate America. He's entrepreneurial. He has a number of activities going on, and he is just a insight of information when it comes to fitness, being a dad, politics, current events. He's just a fantastic conversation. So listen in. You're going to love him. So without further ado, Milan, would you like to kick us off and welcome Spencer?
Let's welcome Spencer then.
All right, here we go. We're on, man. That's awesome. Got it working. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Sweet, dude. So what's going on, man?
Oh, man. Where do you begin? This is such a bizarre time right now, right? It's like, it's a movie.
It is insane.
The weather's been great. It's a shame because it would be great. This is great beach weather, but you can't go to the beach. That's been, you know, like sunny, like upper 80s, got into the 90s a few days, a couple days. But it sucks. You got to be inside. You shut down. Obviously, it's like everywhere else, shut down the parks and limiting activity outside. So it's really bizarre.
So where are you guys living? Are you in Miami or are you outside in South Florida?
We're in South Florida. We're right in between Miami and Fort Lauderdale in a town called Miramar. So in South Broward County.
Okay.
Yeah, South Broward County. Yeah. We're like literally 30 minutes from, let's say, Miami or South Beach, downtown Miami, South Beach, 30 minutes from downtown Fort Lauderdale. So it's a nice little sweet spot.
Do you miss D.C. area at all?
I do miss D.C. I miss my Chinese spot, man. Peking, remember?
That place. You know how many people I've talked to about that place, even in New York. I've told people you have to hit this Peking duck place. It's in this strip mall. Yep. They're like, oh yeah, I've been there. Anybody that's a foodie knows about that place. That to this day, that was the bottom line best duck I've ever had.
I'm telling you, you know, that's the charm of it because it's so unassuming, right? Because it's in a little strip mall. That's part of like the whole charm. You go, you would never expect that. You go in and you just have like the best Chinese meal ever.
Yeah, and you know what? It's funny. It's more than non-assuming. I was like, dude, where is Spencer taking me? It's like this. Like, at that point, we had known each other for about a year, but I was like, man, did I do something?
Set you up, right? Like,
yeah, yeah. I was like, is this the end here, or what's going on? And then we go into this place, and it opens up, and you just see all of these pictures of presidents and diplomats. And it's funny because that was my first experience with duck. And I ate it, and I just remember to this day the taste of it. I've tried it a couple other times, and I do not like it. And so it's crazy how good they make it there.
That is unequivocally my favorite restaurant in the world, unequivocally. I'd rather have a meal there than any other place. I used to do a takeout from there, go there all the time to serve. I had my own waiter, a guy named Poon. I'd say, hey, I want Poon section. He knew me. He'd make my pancakes. So I bring that up because it's impossible to get good Chinese food down here. I don't know why.
I trade it for great Colombian and Peruvian and
Cuban food.
Cuban, yeah. Cuban coffee there is off the hook.
Yeah.
Right, like Asian food's almost non-existent. In New York, the amount of good Asian food, you go down to Chinatown, you can just walk past a hole in the wall and it's incredible.
Exactly. I brought home some food one time to you guys, to Paola, for some chicken called... She came over to the apartment one time, and we had some El Puerto Rico. Let me tell you, that is the best chicken in the country, hands down. When Anthony Bourdain did his episode on DC, that was like one of the first spots, and he even said this is some of the best chicken I've ever had. It's
what's the name of the place?
El Puerto Rico. I mean, it's, just, okay. Yeah, it's rich chicken. It's Peruvian chicken, pollo a la brasa, but it's original. Like, they have pollo a la brasa down here. It's Peruvian, but it's not the same. They do something with those bricks. I don't know what they do. That chicken is so succulent and juicy. Amazing. And it's the first. It was like one of the first. D.C. is interesting because it's like people say, oh, Miami is so diverse. But D.C., I actually take D.C. over for diversity because all the embassies are based in D.C. In South Florida, you got all of your Latin American, South American, some European, there's some Russians, et cetera, but in D.C., you got everything. Yeah, everything. Yeah, Africans, West African, East African. I don't think anyone here has heard of Ethiopian. You know what I mean? In D.C., they're everywhere, you know? And no difference between Ethiopian and Eritrean, for instance.
Ethiopian food, that's another one that's off the hook, right? Like, especially in D.C. I remember the first time I had Ethiopian food and the coffee. I was like, God, man, this is a secret gem out there. And it's interesting that ethnic food has not hit the national radar. Like you have the Peruvian ceviche, you've got the Mexican tacos, right? But man, people are missing out on Ethiopian food.
It's definitely acquired taste, though. If you have the wrong stuff, like if you have some of the raw stuff, it might turn you off, might set you back a couple of years.
Are you into delicacies? How do you ever came up with the word delicacy? I think delicacy, I want some, you know, ice cream. I want some like hamburger, you know what I mean? I don't want like some random raw snail that I've never looked at and am I going to get sick and die off this?
Right. No, I'm actually a very adventurous eater, so I'm game, man. As long as it tastes good, I don't care. I'll try it. I'll do crickets. I'll try it, brother. I'll try it.
What's the craziest type of food you've tried?
I'd probably say crickets when I was in Mexico, I guess. Alligators and frog legs. That's not really crazy. But I'd probably say crickets. That's probably, you know, insects. Anything you do with insects, that's probably, I'd probably take it.
Hey, when you do crickets or insects, you've now left the typical food chain, right? Like you're food chain. Like typically it's us, animals or plants, and then something else after that, and then something else. No, we just skip levels. You're just going to go straight through, forget the middleman.
Exactly. I've tried, when I was in D.C., I did try a lot of Vietnamese food. There was a place in not too far from where our old place was in Annandale called Little Vietnam, and they had like hardcore Vietnamese food, like pork blood, cobra heart. It wasn't like on the regular menu, but like the old, you see these old Vietnamese guys come in and they request it. And I was like, I want to try that. Yeah, I want to try that. You know, cobra heart, stuff like that.
Does Cobra Heart taste like chicken? Because that's usually the response you get.
No, well, see, I've never tried it. I don't know if I had the... Yeah, I don't think I was invited to even try it. I just heard about it, and I put that on my list, never got around to it, but I definitely want to try Cobra Heart. That's why I said crickets is the most adventurous, but there's a lot of things on my list that I want to get to. I have some friends, some clients in the Midwest, and they, one guy's in Omaha, and they have a, I guess it's an annual testicle fair, like bull testicles, and they do a whole bunch of different things with bull testicles. Oh, shit, I'm game. Who knows? Maybe it's aphrodisiac.
I'd want to be told about it after. Tell me it's some meatballs or something, right? Like, just don't tell me what it is, and then tell me afterwards, and I'll be like, oh, you got me, right? I just looked this up while you're talking. It's we'll have to go back to Pennsylvania sometime. It's called Scrapple. Yeah, man, it's literally the bare bones, the neck, the back, the skins, the hooves, the snouts. It's just like whatever's left. Let's put this thing together. That'll tell you how poor that area was at one point. Because people are like, you know what? We're not going to waste anything. That hoof, that looks good. There's got to be some protein in there. Let's squeeze that out.
That's so funny. So that originated in Western Pennsylvania, or Dutch County? I didn't know that, to be honest with you, because we grew up with it in the D.C. area. That's interesting. So I didn't know. That's hitting the new history for me. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's popular. You talk about it being a loyal following for 50 years in the Pennsylvania area. And people that eat it, man, that's like part of their staple breakfast, which is wild. So you've tried it before, too.
Oh, yeah. We used to eat it with eggs. That was a thing. Scrapple in the morning? Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned that. I knew it wasn't like the quality meat, but it was flavorful. It's kind of like in Hawaii, Spam. You know, Spam is like really big in Hawaii.
Yeah, it's crazy. That is a poor man's food. I know we had a lot of it growing up, and it is just, it's gross. But people eat it, and they love it. And other cultures, it's wild to see like what other cultures are eating. Have you seen that wet market out there in China?
Yeah, I seen a little bit and heard a little bit about it, the exotic animals and stuff. Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
It's definitely a cultural thing, you know, right? So, you know, I try to be sensitive to that. Every culture has got different little idiosyncrasies and so forth. So what I might think is or feel is disgusting or not appropriate may not be felt the same way. So I just think we have to be, in regards to that, but in regards to the coronavirus, I just feel as these type of things will arise. You know, our government entities are ready and available. And prepared in Asia, in a lot of countries, you know, Taiwan, as you can see, how they recovered, Hong Kong, how they recovered. They were prepared because they had these type of outbreaks before. So hopefully this was a test run, so to speak. And we are prepared for the next time. Because, you know, my great fear is that if this happened with this type of virus, which has what, like less than 5% mortality rate, 3%, something like that. Imagine if it was the bird flu, which is like 40% mortality, or something which isn't passed with the air, but it almost has like 100% mortality. And somewhere, and this gets in a lab, and this gets in the hands of the wrong people, right? Bioterrorists, or whatever you want to call it. Then we're really not going to be prepared. So I just hope that this was a test run, and we're prepared for the next time.
That's a really interesting perspective, because yeah, myself included at the beginning, do we understand what we're doing to our economy and the percentages, like even at the rate they are, I think they're considered way higher than the reality is because of the limited testing. But we've still went through this exercise and obviously, you know, hopefully it works and it's for good reason. But I had never thought of that as, listen, this is also an opportunity for us to prepare.
Oh,
for
yeah.
Something. These are coming down the line and the world's getting more dangerous and it's just kind of we're more interconnected. And so it's almost like a business continuity test to see like what was right, what was wrong.
Right.
You're right, man. I like that because that gives you a whole different view on like, did we do the right
thing? I mean, just look at South Korea. They had their first case around the same time we did, like third week of January, I think like January 20th or something. And if you look at their curve, I mean, they're big economies. I mean, Seoul is a, you know, first class city. It's right up to par with New York and Tokyo and all the other cities. And so forth, as far as technology and innovation, and they're already on the downward trend. That's because of testing, and they had face masks readily available. They didn't have to shut down their whole scale like we did because they had the tools in place. Now you look at us, you got folks, oh, well, climbing face masks and PPE equipment and all that stuff. They already had that stuff in place. They already went through SARS. They knew it was real. They didn't take it lightly. You know, our administration, so much that in our administration, whether it be Democrat or Republican, it's all politics and so forth. There are people in our you know, our government and people who are like libertarians or who don't believe in the government at all or any taxes. Well, this is where the government comes in. This is why you have government, right? So like if you debase these entities and institutions, you won't have anything to fall back on. You know, you won't have a social safety net. You won't have institutions like NIH doing the research and stuff like that. And these, you know, these countries in Asia, they have that. They take it seriously. I think we should follow their lead, using best cases and practices, and use this as a dry run, because this could have been much worse if there was something airborne that had a higher mortality rate. Unfortunately, it affected people who were, you know, 60 plus or immunocompromised or had underlying conditions. But imagine you had something that affected people across the board. You look at something like TB, which was prevalent in the 30s and 40s and 50s until they had a vaccine. If you caught TB, there was a 1 in 4, 1 in 3 chance you'd die, and like within weeks. And it was airborne. You know, people coughed and then they died. And we never shut down the economy or anything like that. We just had to deal with it. And so this could have been much worse. So I just hope that we heed the advice of the scientists and we this is a test run. We're prepared next time.
Korea nailed it right at the beginning. But they also pointed the reason why they did so well is because they had went through it with SARS. And so it was almost like SARS was their test run, right? And because of that test run, they were ready. So I agree, man. That's a great point. I think I'm going to start stealing that. And what's interesting about Korea, that they definitely leveraged technology. They were doing some Snowden-type monitoring people.
Seoul was like 50 years ahead of us. Korea, they're so far ahead of us. Technology.
Yeah, you remember that movie, Enemy of the State with Will Smith?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they were doing some Enemy of the State type monitoring. If you got Corona, man, you might as well have a satellite over top of your head.
No, they actually, yeah, that's exactly what they're doing. There was trace testing and with your smartphone. Like if a person tested positive, you could go on your smartphone and see how close you were to someone with Corona. And what they did was instead of shutting down the whole economy, they tested everyone, even for antibodies, and they see whoever was positive, they quarantined those people. And obviously, that's the best way to do it. But you can't do it unless you have a test that's readily available and fast. Like, for example, you know, my wife, Valerie, you know, she's in nursing. She's a nurse practitioner. And she got sick a couple of weeks ago, her cough and stuff like that. We found out she had been exposed to some people at her hospital. So but it took her like literally 3 or 4 business days for her to be able to get a test. Like you had to, you know, get an appointment. It was a whole thing. And then it was another 5 business days until the test results came back. Like, come on. We've got to do better than that.
That's not actually even that bad if you think about it. In New York City, at one point, they stopped testing you. Like, if you got sick and you called and said, I want to get a test, they said, don't come in unless you need to be hospitalized.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, man, I hear you. And then people that were getting tests, most of them, if they tested positive, they found out they tested positive after they went through like the 2-week cycle. And so they've already finished the symptoms, and then they come back and, oh, yeah, you were positive. It's like, oh, great. That's helpful. I don't know.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah.
It's insane, man. It's insane. Yeah, yeah. What they were doing, like what Korea did was wild. And so you were in security at one point in your career. And so what's your thought on Big Brother, you know, data monitoring view of the world? You think it's worth the privacy that we lose to be able to manage something like this?
It's funny you mentioned that. I actually don't think of it from my old life, working in clubs, being a bouncer and security and type of stuff and bodyguard work. But I think about it from my new life because I work in lead generation. I'm VP of operations for a lead generation company. And so we're in digital lead generation. And basically, you know, that's a fancy way of saying we buy and sell data, right? Consumer information and data. That's exactly what we do. And what I try to tell people all the time out there is that your information is already out there. People are so guarded about their information. It's not, you know, your information like Jonathan Sierra, he lives at this address, he's born here. They know all that stuff. What they want to know are, what are your habits? What do you like to do? What are you going to do? What are you thinking? That's the information that is so valuable. Your basic information, your name, your number, all that stuff's out there. But the thing is, they want to take that information to better service you in different ways, whether it be, like you said, this whole thing with tracing as far as the virus is concerned, or whether it be advertisers and making sure that they try to service you up the right product when you're online. So the information is already out there. And I think it's just a natural course of evolution. I think it's really futile when folks try to stop it. Like, you can choose to live off the grid, you know, say, hey, live in a place with no cell towers and, you know, have your own electricity and all that type of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's going to happen. You know, so I think that the best thing you can do, you know, is just be aware and be proactive about the information that's out there and just know the information that's out there and make sure it's correct. But the information is already out there. I like the idea of sort of revenue share with that information, because here's the thing. There are companies that are making money hand over fist off of your information. And the thing that sucks that I look at it is that people are not making the money off of it. It's Mark Zuckerberg and it's Google and Facebook and it's Instagram. It's those companies, TikTok. Those are the companies that are making all the money off of your data, whereas you should be making some of that money off of that data. I think there should be a revenue share of that information. So that's a model I'd like to get into a little bit later. And that's actually a project that I'm sort of working on from the entrepreneurial standpoint, developing an app and so forth. I can't really get into too much of it right now because we're sort of in the alpha stage. But I firmly believe that we should lean into big data and not be afraid of it, because it's like a tidal wave. It's inevitable.
The data out there, for me personally, maybe because I'm technically considered the first year of millennial, although closing out on 40 years old, I don't feel so millennial these days. My back, my knees don't, certainly. But I never really had a issue with like my data being used. Now, I do think that it's interesting that somebody else gets to make money off exactly. the data that I use, right? And so that's a great point. And I love the fact that you're doing something entrepreneurial. And so you can't talk about it. That means that absolutely get to bring you back for a second repeat.
Absolutely. I'm itching. As a matter of fact, my partners, hey, we need to have a call today. I say, I can't, man. I'm doing a podcast because we're all over the place. I got one partner in California. The other one who's Slovenian, but he's based here in South Florida. So we're just always trying a hard time linking up, getting our schedules synced, because we all have full time jobs as well, so in careers. So we're trying to do this sort of side projects, but we know that it's necessary. We absolutely know that it's necessary.
That entrepreneurial road, when you know you have mouths to feed and you have responsibilities that you can't just throw hell to the wind and live in a small studio. It's not an easy task to do a day job, manage a family, and build a project on the side.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You gotta do your thing on the side, because otherwise 20 years from now you're gonna look back and you're gonna regret it. You don't want to live with regrets, right?
Yeah, man, you gotta try. It's good to catch up. It's funny. We talk about you guys a lot, probably more than you would even realize, because you were our first friends that actually had a child. And so, you know, we were just starting our life. We had gotten married. We were living in that building with you, you know, same building that you all were and Columbia Pike. And so I remember you guys had Genevieve, and she was just the most freaking cute kid. And so what's crazy, though, what we do talk about is then you guys made a decision to move down to South Florida. And I remember us being bummed because we didn't get a chance to really hang out before. And we're like, oh, man, wish we would have gotten some time. They were just too busy before they left. And we just had no appreciation of what you guys must have been going through whenever you were trying to move this with a kid, right? Like a baby. And then we had a baby. And, man, for the last 6 years, it's been hang on. And so my wife and I, whenever we talk about – like examples of, you know, how you think it'll be to be a parent and then how it is in execution, we always use that as a starting place. We're like, yeah, we had these friends, they had a baby, they were moving to South Florida, we really wanted to hang out with them, but then they just took off. And then we couldn't understand why they didn't have enough time. And then we have Milan and we're like, holy cow, like, boy, were we dumb. You know, and so it must have been pretty wild having to move. And now, how old is Genevieve? She's got to be like 8 or 9 years old, right?
She is 7. She'll be 8 in October.
Jeez, I was looking at pictures and she's so big. Have you guys had a good time in the South Florida region? Are you glad you made the move?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely acclimated. Like I said, we started the call. There's definitely things I miss about DC, family, friends, conversations, the whole political environment. But I've definitely acclimated to South Florida. South Florida is an easy place to transition to, because South Florida, Florida in general, but South Florida in particular, is everyone's from somewhere else, basically, from down here. They would say that Florida is like the fifth or sixth borough of New York. It's so true. You have so many New Yorkers down here and, you know, people from everywhere. You can just literally just come here, set up shop. No one asks questions, because that's just the nature of Florida. So we've definitely got acclimated. My blood is definitely thin whenever I go up north, whether it be going to New York on business or come back to D.C. I'm freezing cold and I'm used to wearing shorts every day. So when I got to put on, you know, regular clothes, it's like, what is this? So I'm definitely acclimated to Florida.
And you had a second kid, too, along the way.
Yeah, we had a boy, right? As soon as we got down here, found out, and he came back, oh, pregnant, like, woo, yay, you know. So it was baby boy. He's our youngest. His name's Gavin. Gavin Spencer Colbert gave him my middle name, or my name or middle name. And he's just a character. Everyone knows him. So he's been here before. He just does things his own way. He eats everything backwards, whether it be slice of pizza, cheeseburgers. He uses middle finger instead of his pointer finger. And he loves to twerk. He's a character. I don't know how else to say it. He's a character. Keeps me entertained.
It's pretty wild to see the pictures we were going through last night just to get prepped for the interview and see the things that you've been doing. And man, you've been able to get bigger and more lean. So what is the freaking secret? When we lived in DC, like you were Jack, you're a big dude. And I haven't had a chance to talk about that. I don't know your exact specs, but man, you gotta be like 6'2", 6'3", you know, 250 up, right? Like,
I definitely, I didn't get bigger. I think some of my muscles have gotten bigger, but I got leaner, and it didn't happen like overnight. As soon as I moved down here to Florida, what happened was, I mean, I was always like a big guy, but I think that once parenthood hit, cause I also had a 14-year-old as well. I don't know. You never got a chance to meet him from a previous relationship. It didn't work out, and he went to live with his mom. So I usually got him for the summers and stuff like that. So it was like we were trying to co-parent, part-time parenting and so forth. But it's not like I am today. I'm not like fully involved, you know, making the lunches, picking him up from camp or school or whatever. I'm much more involved now. But certainly when I became a dad in 2006 and even the second go-round, 2012, Genevieve came and then Gavin in 2014, rather, I started to pick up weight. Dead weight. I don't know if you've noticed it or it's happened to you, but you definitely, for me, I think that we call sympathy weight. When she's pregnant, everybody sort of diet sort of lets go. And then, you know, just get older, your metabolism starts to slow down. And so you can't eat what you normally ate. And then you're working and you have less time to work out. You become more sedentary. I started to pack on pounds. I really didn't like the way I looked at pictures. This is even after I moved down here. It started snowball. And then I would say the beginning of like last year, the year was 2020. So yeah, like halfway 2018, I really got into it. I mean, I always go into the gym, but then I started to really count my calories and stuff like that. And then halfway beginning of last year, I had some people in the gym, you know, who said, man, you should really do a bodybuilding competition. You got the shoulders and stuff like that. I was always afraid because I didn't want to do the dieting. I heard that was like really brutal, doing like those competitions for the diet. And come on, man, you should try it. And Val, you know, wife, she's my biggest supporter. She said, you should do it. And I think part of it was she just wanted me to get, but she pushed me to do it. And she was supportive. It took up a lot of time. And at some point, what happens is you become addicted to the results. And that's what happened. You turn a corner and it's like you start to see yourself different in the mirror. You like the way your clothes fit. You think to the compliments. And it's like after that, it's no turning back. And you start thinking to yourself, what was I waiting for? Oh, my God. No?
You were in great shape and you were a massive gym. I'd always feel pretty good. And then I'd look up and I'd be like, you got to be kidding me. Why is he working out at the same time I am here?
Around the corner from us. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd look up every once in a while. You'd be there and be like, oh, there goes my confidence for the next hour. Like, because you start looking in the mirror and yeah, man, I'm looking big. I'm looking good. Then I'd see you in the background. Like, yeah, that sucks. Like I'm not that big. But man, I had the same stuff go on when we had Milan. It just happens little by little. Like it was, all right, I'm tired. So you miss a gym and then you're stressed. So you eat a little bit. And then before you know it, you try to get back in and there's, you know, get a couple weeks in and something comes up, the kid gets sick or teething. And so then you just really had a hard time at consistency. I got to the point where my body started breaking down and I went to a physical therapist and he was, you got three choices. Your first is you can just keep letting this go and you're going to be that one of those hunkered, you know, people walking around or limping around from, you know, meeting to meeting. The second is I can start getting you some medication. Or the third is you can make some changes. Mm-hmm. And so that scared me. And I started making some changes. You're right. Like, I don't know if you went through this, but I didn't realize, you know, from the difference when I was 25 and I took a few months off to when you're 35 or 36 and you start trying to get back into it. My God, did it take me a while. Like, I, you know, every inch was a victory for me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 100%. And that's exactly it. It's all about the quality of life that you have. Like, I feel like I have a much higher quality of life now. Now that I've definitely trimmed some of the body fat, got a little bit healthier. My blood pressure is a lot better, sleeping better. Life's happier, if you know what I mean. So it's a domino effect. And I tell people all the time, and I'm very candid about it. When folks ask for advice and stuff, I say the first thing you want to start with is you want to get a physical. And I actually am a big proponent of hormone replacement therapy. I used to be in the gym all the time. and not getting the results I thought I needed, or results I thought I should earn or get. And what you realize is your body's not performing at an optimal level. So that's why it's important you go in, you know, you get a physical, get your hormones checked. You want to make sure that your testosterone, estrogen is running well, your thyroid hormones are in check and everything's good there. Obviously, your kidneys, everything is working the way it's supposed to work, and it's efficient. Your body's a machine. It's no different than a car going in for a diagnostic check. So I think that's, you know, for me, that's one of the biggest things, or the biggest turning points too, is really taking my health seriously and everything.
I went through that process as well, and I was a big advocate. My problem with the hormone replacement therapy was that I gained a lot of water weight. So I'm talking to my doctor now around how do you take that and still keep the level without the water gain? Because I get a rounded face real quick. But for the listeners out there, Spencer, I think that that's something that's not common knowledge, you know, and as dads, you're losing your testosterone, and you're getting older, and you've got more stress, and it creates this downward cycle. A lot of people would liken that to, you know, these dangerous, you know, steroid use and things, and it's just not,
no,
right? And
no,
so
no.
You know, maybe you can kind of highlight what your thoughts are on that, because I think this is a great point. This is something that people are out there having this same challenge.
Yeah.
You know, they should definitely consider.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's absolutely not. Here's the thing. When people think about steroids, the only commonality between hormone replacement therapy and quote unquote steroids is that, or anabolic steroids as they call, is that you both, there's exogenous, right? So what's happening, what you want to do with hormone replacement therapy is you want to stabilize your body. You want to get back to normal levels, or levels that were optimal for you. And that's why I say it starts with a physical, it starts with doing your blood work, starts with knowing where you're at. And then once from there, you can consult your doctor, and your doctor gets, okay, well, like for me, I found out my testosterone, even though I was big, you know, I was in the gym, I was lifting weights, my testosterone was really low. And that told me I wasn't gaining the amount of muscle mass I thought I was going to gain. Cause I'm like in the gym, I'm like Kobe, I'm like going hard, I'm always going to push myself. But if you don't see the results, then what's the point? Right. And the same thing, and it's a cycle. So if you don't get good sleep, you don't recover, you're not eating well, like if you're craving sweet foods, that's a huge indicator. If you're just craving crap all the time, I don't have the cravings anymore. You know what I mean? So like hormone replacement therapy is about getting your body back to optimal levels. And for most men, it means getting to a hormone level, I'd say you're between 18 to 25, right? So like if you're 18 to 25, typically you have a testosterone level of like 500 to 600. Your thyroid hormones are good. So that means your metabolism working good. Your kidneys are working good. Everything is in an optimal place. Because it's not just one thing. You want to make sure all your systems in your body are working correctly. Because if one thing is out of balance, you want to make sure you have a hormone replacement a program that addresses any and all needs. And to the point about the holding water, that's actually very common and very prevalent. What I found is that you need to have a doctor or a program that adjusts for you. That you know, because what happened for me was I found out like my estrogen, I got on it, and then my estrogen level became high. Because what happens is a feedback loop. If you up your testosterone, what happens is it aromatizes and it turns to estrogen. So he had to up my anti-estrogen, and then I had my sweet spot, right? So there was no more water retention, no more water weight, all this type of stuff, and you know, it was good. So you're absolutely right. You have to do it the right way, and that's one of the reasons why I tell people to go to professionals, because when folks go on the black market and try to do stuff, that's when you get these nasty sort of, you know, reactions and all these side effects. Because, A, you don't know where you're getting it from. You're getting it from these dark labs, and you don't know what they're mixing it with. You want to make sure you get your stuff from a compounded pharmacy that's licensed. They send it to you. Everything's good. You get your test, whether it's a quarterly test, half yearly, whatever it is. Because everyone reacts differently. You might get on it, and then you find out your blood pressure's high. So you got to come off it, or you got to adjust something. So you want to make sure everything is working correctly. And it's not a magic pill. I just want to point that out. You still have to eat right. You still have to get your rest. Nothing is a magic pill. But it's one of the things you can put in your arsenal to help you live a better life.
What did you do? I guess if somebody's sitting out there just trying to be, okay, that sounds cool. Like, how do I even start the conversation with my doctor? Because I think one of the key tenets of the Dad Corp and what we're trying to do, and you'll see this theme go through the conversation, is that there's no real support for dads. And maybe you can broaden that even say men in general, right? Like we're not the best communicators. Let's just put that out there, right? And so we always suffer in silence. And so what we're trying to do is say, listen, like, you're not the only one out there. And, you know, my partner and I say, if we opened ourselves up and started doing some things like this podcast, our friends and our network would open up and share their insights into things that they go through. And then you'll also start to see that we're not all alone, right? Like many of us are going through the same stuff. Clearly, you and I have hit a similar point and went down a path and we figured it out, right? But not everybody's either figured it out or there's a lot of things I haven't figured out. So what does a person that's sitting there saying, okay, well, I'm interested in knowing more or doing something. What do I even say to my doctor? So how did you even start that conversation?
Well, I want to say that all this stuff is elective. Typically, is going to be outside of your primary care physician. So if you have insurance and you have a primary care physician, great, but you're going to have to see a doctor that specializes in hormone replacement therapy. And I will say this it's a really good time because the cost for a lot of these services have gone down tremendously over the past couple of years, tremendously to the point where I've seen some advertisements that range anywhere from $100 a month. It's crazy. So to your point, you don't have to go to the black market. You can absolutely, you know, get your body optimized to the right levels at a cost that, in my opinion, is much cheaper than traditional health care. And I'm not saying that to replace. You need health care. Let me be clear about that. What I'm getting is you want to take a proactive approach to your health care, right? Me personally, I probably spend, maybe $400 a month on supplements. Easy. That's omega-3 fatty acids, different herbs, different multivitamins, getting stuff right in my digestion. But here's the trade-off. I almost never get sick. Almost completely, rarely ever get sick. My blood pressure is controlled. Cholesterol is great. I feel great. I have an abundant amount of energy. Whenever I tell people my age, and I do use a little bit of Just for Men for my beard, but whenever I tell people my age, no one believes it. I'll be 41 in 2 weeks. And everyone's, oh, no way. You know, I'm in the gym and absolutely no one believes it. So I think that if you just take a proactive approach to your health, it will pay off. You just have to stay the course and you have to really believe it. You have to say, okay, what's more important? Is it with driving that? If you have a limited budget, is it driving that luxury car or looking great? I'm going to tell you something right now. I've done both. And you'll get much more attention, positive attention from looking great. If you have a choice between, let's say, a 7 Series Beamer and a Toyota, or looking great and looking a bit fat sloppy, I'm going to be look great, drive the Toyota. I'm just saying.
On that point, there's actually been a lot of published research that's come out recently talking about people that are healthy and working out, regardless of their income, they actually are happier and feel better than anybody at any income, right? And I believe that, man. Like when I was going through my career, I kept, you know, getting to the next level, but I was actually getting less happy because I was looking at myself in the mirror and you see it little bit by little bit. And, you know, then one day, man, that's who is that? And then also you start to feel it, which is the worst, right? Like one thing about the aesthetics, but there's another thing around the feeling when it starts to impact like your energy levels, your mood levels. So I think that's a fantastic point. And where do you read up on your stuff? So if anybody's trying to figure out, okay, well, I not only don't want to talk to my doctor, but interested in starting a program or sort of interested in like reading up on health, making sure I'm knowledgeable around, you know, some of the things you talked about, the supplements, like where do you get your information?
There's some great vloggers on YouTube, to be honest with you. I think video has become a great way to consume information. After our call, we can talk offline, but there's some great vloggers on YouTube that have some great, there's a lot of junk out there as well, but there's some guys out there with a lot of great information with what I call like life hacks. I'll give you an example. One quick example is I always have like a tablespoon of diluted apple cider vinegar before bed. And what that does is it cuts your blood sugar. And why that's important is because before bed, you have all these biological processes that are happening. And if your blood sugar is too high, it can't happen. If you become sensitive to insulin and so forth, what's going to happen is you're going to store fat around your belly. So that's one of the, like you said, it creeps up on you, right? So it's like little things. You eat too late to bed, your carbs and stuff like that, it'll creep up on you. When you're like 18, 19, 17, 18, it doesn't big deal. But as you get older, it does. So that's like one little hack. And that's one of the things I learned from, I can't think of his name now, a great vlogger on YouTube, just taking like apple cider vinegar tablespoon of that, apple cider vinegar with mother, with diluted with water right before bed, something like that. And then first thing in the morning, those little things are tremendous. I started doing keto diet. I don't do this all the time, but I did it to sort of like change up your habits. So I think the variety is really important. You know, I'm not going to be a proponent of any particular diet. Like, if you're vegan, great. If you eat, great. If you're keto, great. Whatever it is that works for you. And that's another thing. By doing the bodybuilding competition, that was one of the best things that ever happened to me. Because what I learned was I learned about my body. Because what happens is you get a coach, you get a nutritionist, all these people say, hey, try this, try that. They give you things that work for other people. And you do these things, and you got to figure out what works for yourself. But you're doing it in a fashion that has a deadline. It's not like now, oh, I want to try this, I want to try that. You say, hey, my bodybuilding show is October 16th, but I got this many weeks to get right. And you look at your schedule, then you change this, you change that, you cut your macros. And, you know, everyone out there, you know what your macros are, right? That's your split of your protein, carbohydrates, and fat. And everyone's different. Some people work great with high carbs. Some people work great with low carbs. So, like, everyone's different. You have to work. You have to figure out what works right for you. There's no one size fits all box. But the key is you want to start testing, and you know how your body feels. So that was one of the best things that ever happened to me. But doing that show, it caused me, to your point, caused me to go out there and look for information, for resources. Look, you don't have to be a doctor, but you should at least know what you put in your body, right? So take all of my advice with a grain of salt, do your own research. But I'm just saying you should at least know what you're putting in your body. That's all I'm saying. And I think that true health starts in the kitchen. They always say the abs are created in the kitchen. It's true. You know, whatever you put in your body, you can't outwork. I love to work out and love to work. I'm a gym rat. I love, like, some people don't like working out. I love it. And so for me, it's easy. The hard part would have always been the diet. Now that I figured that out, it's over with. It's trouble.
I would love to get some of those links. We're starting a YouTube channel that we've had for a while, and we're really building it out. And one of the things that we're doing is creating these playlists for anything around that advice, health, workouts, music lists, things like that, that we've gotten feedback on. So you'll definitely have to share that with me. And it's interesting on the workout thing. You hear a lot of people, oh, I was never into weightlifting. That's cool. Like, no worries, man. There's other things out there. Like, at this point, with the amount of, sports and activities and just overall online videos, and we got yoga, you got CrossFit, you got martial arts. There's something out there that you can start getting into. It doesn't have to be a weight program. You know, some people love to be in the gym pumping some iron. Some people like to do yoga, but just get active. I think that, for me, that was huge, right? Like, just getting consistently active for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week or 4 days a week, was the starting place. And then it became, okay, well, how do I maximize that 30 minutes? And then it became, okay, well, then I can do 30 minutes hard. Like, can I do 35? Right. And so you just got to find a starting place. And even if that's 10 minutes, you start getting active and moving in the right direction.
Oh, absolutely. You don't need much. So there's a workout called Tabata, which is like 4 minutes long. It's do these 4 minute intervals over like half an hour. And it gives you, from a VO2 standpoint, like VO2 max, it gives you the same type. It gives you more intense workout than you've worked out for 90 minutes. So it doesn't have to be long. You got to find your sweet spot, whatever works for you. Absolutely right.
Man, you want to talk about like the exercise. It doesn't have to be long or hard. I got into this yoga flow. It's called Halo. It's an app out there that I've been using. And so you pay this $20 subscription and they have all these instructors that give classes. I've been using this lady that does Pilates, man.
That's one thing I haven't tried. I will try it, but I haven't tried it.
Bring Val, because it is a humbling experience, and she needs to videotape that for you. My God, you don't use weights in these poses where you're just basically lifting up your leg, and why is this burning so hard? And this lady's just calmly breathing, going from exercise to exercise for like 35 straight minutes. And you just see me flopping from, you know, position to position, just struggling to like lift my leg a couple inches and hold it. How is that so hard? But it is a humbling experience because it's different muscles, different movements. And it's amazing how like you just tweak a few things. Your body is just not used to it. And so it creates that much more pressure and tension to actually complete the exercise.
Oh, now I got to try it. It sounds like a challenge.
Especially for men like us, one of the benefits that I've seen is you know, and by no means, you know, am I going to put myself in the same category as you from a weightlifting perspective, but I'm a decent sized guy. And so I love to do the weights as well. And I used to do a lot of, you know, mixed martial arts training, but my stabilizer muscles, as I've gotten older, you know, sitting, being at the desk, they're so weak. And so doing a certain simple exercise where you're just putting a little bit of stress into stabilization or the balance burn that I feel within like 15 seconds of holding that is just incredible. And afterwards, I actually feel more stable. And that's something that I've struggled with, is just feeling good and feeling stable, getting my posture right.
You know, absolutely. In the gym, people come to me all the time at the gym with like weightlifting advice. And I always tell people, start with your core. If you start with your core, everything else will become strong, because that's what stabilizes, you know, everything else. All the other extremities, all the other compound muscle groups, whether it be, like I always tell people, I say, you want to bench a lot, you have a strong back. Because you can't, you know, you aren't going to be able to lift 400 pounds off the bar, 300 pounds, 400 pounds off the bar, unless you can stabilize it first. Same thing for a squat. You want to squat 500 pounds, make sure you deadlift, so forth. I tell people all the time, that's the king of exercising. You know, when I was on these bodybuilding shows, it was so shocking to me when I looked at my pictures, like, man, and even today I still have a little bit. It was like a six pack. All my life, I never grew up, you know, I was a big guy, but I didn't really have like a six pack or nothing. But I got it. I still don't do a lot of ab exercise. I do like the roll and stuff like that, a few hanging leg raises, but I'm not doing like 1,000 sit ups and crunches, all the other nonsense. What I'm doing is high intensity interval training that cuts the fat, and also core exercise. Because if you have a strong core, people don't realize your abdominals are a core muscle. If you have a strong core, then everything else just falls into place. It's just like easy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you said that, because when I went to that physical therapist, he enlightened me in a way that I had never thought of, but it was like one of the most logical Yoda type moments. He was looking at me, and he walks through the assessment, and he does a stretch in different ways, and he looks where the pain is. Then he looks at me and says, hey, listen, like, you've got a core issue. And let me explain to you what that means to me. Is a lot of people, when they go to the gym, and this is yourself included, especially as they start to run out of time and they're busy, they're not warming up and stretching out. That starts to go at the wayside. Then because you only have a limited amount of days, and you might be only going 2 or 3 days a week, you're going to do what you like to do because it's fun. And so then you're only probably bench pressing, you're probably curling, you're probably doing some sit-ups. And he's like, meanwhile, you're spending 12 hours a day at your desk, and all of that's doing is creating tension on the front part of your body where you're already starting to get bad posture. He's like, your core is also your butt. He's like, you have a butt problem. And he used the words ass. He's like, you have an ass problem. He's like, your hamstrings are tight, your legs are not strong, your lower back is weak. Like, that's good, preventing you from holding yourself up in a good posture. You're using muscles that are bringing you forward. He's like, you need to start deadlifting.
I love this guy.
I was like, isn't that the exercise that kills you or hurts you? I'm not talking about putting 400 pounds on. I'm saying start out with 50 pounds and just start deadlifting. And 50 pounds for me is like, you know, a quarter of my weight, less than that. So it's really light. It's actually humbling to put 50 pounds on a bar, and other people are bench pressing 300 pounds and you're deadlifting, you know, 50 pounds, right? But you would be shocked, Spencer. I did that 50-pound deadlift for a couple months. The first time I think you walked
in. John, let me tell you, you're preaching to the choir. First of all, I love the deadlift. That's the king exercises. I have a lot of posts about that in my IG feed and stuff, but also the lightweight. That's another thing I learned by doing this bodybuilding competition, is that you want to stick with lightweight. I tell people all the time, it's better to do the movement and the form right than to lift a lot of weights, because all you're doing is cheating yourself. And so when you're working with lighter weight, likelihood is that you're going to do a full range of motion and you're going to do the form correct. So when I was training in my competition, I was in my gym, you know, everybody's looking at me, why is he messing with these lightweights? He's curling 25 pounds. Or his leg pressing only 2 plates, while all these other guys got like 10 plates on there. I didn't realize I was working on my form. I was literally squeezing out every single rep, creating separation, definition, and detail. You know, training, literally training and just prepping the muscle. And that is an art unto itself. So I absolutely agree. Don't sleep on those lighter weights.
Yeah, and I love how you hit the actual putting the tension in detail, because you can make something as easy and as hard. And so if you use bad form, it feels light, but you're actually doing a disjustice to yourself. Even in that Pilates class I'm telling you about, they'll make you just squeeze a certain way, right? Or just move your hips a certain way. And it puts so much more tension on your overall body. And so that technique is so critical to make sure you're getting the full benefit, but you're also doing it in a way that's healthy and helps you progress and not actually harmful to your body. So tell me, how did you end up doing on the bodybuilding contest? You look great, the six pack. I still don't think you've given me the specs on how big you are right now, but if anybody saw a picture of you, when you talk about a six pack, that's an impressive
feature. Well, right now I'm sitting there, I'm 6'2 and some change, not quite 6'2. Well, if I have Air Maxes on, I'm 6'3. But no, I'm 6'2. And probably sitting right now, right like 275. When I was on stage, I was at 264, I think I weighed in at. But during competition, I got down to 255, 256, somewhere in there. But to give some perspective, when you knew me, we were neighbors and stuff, I was in the 290s and carried it well. But I get winded, or you bend over to tie your shoes, and you get a little lightheaded and dizzy, you know, blood pressure's a little high. And now, even though I'm 275, I feel light as a feather, like a jump rope, so forth, because I cut a lot of the body fat, right? And I learned how to use my muscles a lot more efficiently. I did a hell of a lot of cardio for that competition. I did the 40 plus, I came in second, and then I did super heavyweight, which is 225 plus, and I came in third. And I would have came in a little bit higher if my conditioning was right. And I didn't take posing as serious as I should have. I should have studied posing a lot more beforehand. You know, I'd literally never been to a bodybuilding show ever. Like, I'd seen clips and stuff, but I never actually went to a show and know the whole process. And I didn't realize how much posing is it's a sport, right? It's not just whoever looks the best. You actually have to do these mandatory poses and have a routine. I literally crammed for a routine in 20 minutes, and my son is the one who gave me my idea for a different routine. It was crazy. I was looking at like old videos on YouTube, like the old greats, like what would Arnold do and Sergio Olivia and all these guys. And my son is the one who ended up giving me my routine. But yeah, so it's a sport, right? So I didn't take it as a sport. I just looked at it as training, you step on stage. But it was actually one of the best things I ever did, because it's one thing when you think you have confidence. Another thing, when you stand up there in some briefs, and you have a whole audience of judges critiquing on every little nook and cranny of your body. And you realize that you've been training this body for, in my case, 12 weeks and dieting and looking in the mirror and doing everything you possibly can to look the best. And so your confidence goes through the roof, particularly when you hit a pose and people start cheering. And then after the show, they're in the hotel and folks, little kids want to take photos and look at you like superheroes. And my oldest son, who's 14, telling all his friends about you, and they hit you up on Instagram, and he's lying to his friends saying, oh yeah, my dad's in the NFL. You know, that's the reason why I did it, to be honest with you, because I wanted to make my kids proud. And there's not a better feeling in the world, I tell you.
Yeah, and I'm sure they were. That's pretty impressive. Second and third in those categories in your first show, you got to be proud of that.
I was looking at the calendar this year. I wanted to take some time off to have fun, because during the training process, I wasn't having fun. Like, I was so busy doing the dieting and wearing everything is right. And then afterwards, I just got back in the gym and started having fun again. And I started growing. Like, I looked at my photos and I think I look terrible. Right. But to the average eye, they're like, oh, that's great, because they see where I came from. But now I'm looking at details like, oh, my legs could have been, you know, more detailed, more defined and bigger. But, you know, my biceps, you know, I'm looking at every little thing I see. All I see is flaws. And so now I was back in the gym before all this corona hit, and my legs were just popping. Everything was looking great. So I was trying to get right and just decide on a show probably like, you know, September. And then since I came in second in one of the categories, I qualified for a pro card, meaning like going to one of the shows. And if I got, I want to say either first or second, I could get a pro card. And all that means is that you can call yourself a professional bodybuilder. It's not like I'm trying to change careers or anything like that. It was, hey, I get to this level, then, hey, I'm retired. I'm out. You know, I say I did it, you know. I got to put a little thumb in my feather in my cap. So I was actually looking forward to that and adding some more size and definition and detail now that I've been through the process. Because before, I didn't know what to expect. Now I know what to expect, and I know, you know, how my body reacts.
And I could see that becoming something where you just iteratively want to get better and you just see where the improvements come from. What are you doing with the coronavirus? Are you finding a place to work out? Are you doing some home workouts? Like what have you been doing to keep yourself active and busy?
I'm not going to lie. The past week, when it first hit, I said, when they shut down the gyms, I think it was like March 16th. We all thought it would be like to the end of the month or a week or so. So I was like, just take off a week, let my joints heal. Because when you're constantly lifting heavy weights, you got a little nagging injuries, but you kind of like, you push through them. So I figured, I'll take some time off, just do a little cardio outside. And then, we're going to the parks, we're doing some running, some sprints, some chin-ups. Then they shut the parks down. And then it became, we just started walking around the neighborhood. And I'm not going to lie, that became kind of boring. And I haven't worked out in several days. I've probably been a week since I've worked out. Done some push-ups around the house and stuff like that. But I'm not going to lie, the gym for me wasn't just physical. A lot of it was mental and emotional, and it was an outlet. It was a resource. It was a day a couple weeks ago, I felt like I was having a panic attack because I'm so used to waking up in the morning and taking my pre-workout, hitting the gym. It was like a routine for me, and it's like all of a sudden the routine is gone. Now, I know they didn't look at that as essential, but for me, going to the gym, working out, that was essential. And then you take those things away, I didn't have the coping mechanisms to deal with the stress, high-level stress job and parenting. You got your kids at home, you're trying to homeschool. So it's really been, for me, it's actually been very difficult. And I cannot wait for the gyms to reopen.
You're not the only one. I certainly went through it. Living in New York City, we've got about 1,000 square feet for three people. And so we got about 350 square feet per capita going on here. And it gets tight. And I'm the same way. Like for me, it's like getting outside, getting some fresh air, having my routine, going and getting into my place where I get a little bit of me time and independent time where I'm just not dealing with emails and I'm not dealing with family. I'm just dealing with the focus and the exercise and the breathing. And it's tough, man. Like coming back, like I've actually switched over to that Aloe app that I was telling you about, and I've challenged myself to try to do a full hour of yoga each day or yoga/Pilates. And when I say that, what's funny is an hour doesn't seem that bad, but because of my conditioning with this type of exercising, an hour takes me almost an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes, because I'm trying to do an hour of actual activity, not like an hour of a class, right? So I want to make sure I'm moving for that hour and the breaks that I have to take. But it's hard. And talking to my wife about things like that, sometimes I just have to go take a walk because you just need, I think sometimes as a father, a man, wired a little bit differently, where we need a little bit of space sometimes just to have something that's ours and to kind of vent so that we can get our energy to keep living the life that we need to support our families.
Yeah, no, 100%. I really appreciate the platform you've created and the dialogue you created about being fathers, because you're absolutely right. You look at moms and mother, and women in general and moms, they have all these outlets and they have a community in which mothers pass down tips to their daughters, right? And how often do we as men do that for our sons or our children in general, or have guidance? So many of us are just almost like we're learning on the fly what it is to be a good husband, to be a good father, and so forth and so on. And I think we need to share more of our stories and share more of our experiences. Because I think that we as men take for granted our role. Our role is extremely important in our children's lives. But oftentimes society is like the old saying between Mother's Day and Father's Day. Mother's Day is this big holiday and Father's Day sort of diminished. And I understand why that is. Moms are extremely important. We all love our moms. That's our first caretaker. But dads have a unique role in their children's lives. And I think we need to do more as men to be supportive of other men so we can become better fathers and highlight fatherhood, make it a really like cool thing. And I'm happy that you're doing that.
I could not have said that better, man. And you're probably going to be plastered on some meme of ours at some point for saying that. So thank you. It's you're right. Like, and that's a finding that I had. And I don't know your background. I'd love to hear it. But for me, I grew up without a father, so I didn't have a role model. And I think when you have that example, you have two paths. Either you do the same with that one, or you go down the path of being fully engaged because you never want your children to feel like you felt, right? And I went down the second path, but that doesn't mean I had a role model to be able to look to or people to ask advice to. So I've been fortunate to have friends like yourself. Said you were one of the first parents. And I still, Spencer, I still remember this day when you were getting ready to leave South Florida. You left a memorable implant in my head about what it's like to have that responsibility. You were talking about a client that owed you money from a sale you did. And I just remember you saying, like, that's taking food off of my family's table, by the way, they're not paying. And I was like, I didn't. You know, that's so fascinating because that's the thought process you're already in. And so when I had Milan, those types of comments that stuck with me, those were the ways I was, well, that's how a good father should be, right? And I also think that, like you said, to Father's Day, there's so many jokes about us being silly or not being able to be competent. But I look at the playgrounds. You said you were making sandwiches. We're making the sandwiches. We're taking the kids to school. We're giving the hugs. We're telling the stories, right? And then we're also out there killing ourselves. And it's 50-50. Like our wives are all there too, but it's a different generation.
You know, look, I'll be the first to admit, my wife probably hear this. She's by far the better caretaker, I'm gonna admit. But I'm there every night because she works at night. She's a nurse. She's gonna be transferring today, hopefully soon. But I'm there. I sleep with them every single night. I'm not gonna lie. When it's my nights, they go to bed a little later. I may do things a little. She's more regimented. I will admit, kids get away with more with me, but I'm there every single night. But she's by far the better caretaker. And I definitely follow her lead. She's the leader. I'm not gonna lie. But yeah, it's a grind. It really is a grind. I say that to say we need outlets to share our experience, to know that we're not going crazy, right? You know, as fathers, as dads, because it's better than that than to be absentee, right? To like throw our hands up, oh, fuck it, I'm not doing this. You know, that a lot of our fathers, not mine, you know, mine was there, my grandfather was there, so forth, but a lot of guys I knew, dads, they weren't there because it didn't work out with their, you know, their house father or they had other things going on. They may in and out of jail, drug addiction, whatever it might be. What I'm saying is they didn't have outlets. And for a lot of women, you look at women, they don't. That was never an option. There's some women who abandon their children. But women in society are looked at first and foremost as the caregivers. And if a woman abandoned their child, they would be just absconded. But we as men, for whatever reason, I don't know what it is. There are a lot of guys. Like I meet a guy and I may know a guy for a year and I find out he has kids. Until like a year later. Now, typically those aren't kids he lives with. They might be like, paying child support or something like that. But if I meet you and you have children, I want to know about that. Like the first time I meet you, that's a part of your DNA. That's a part of your makeup, who you are. And I think that we need to really push that narrative in society to be more active fathers.
I've met a number of people that, and to your point, for whatever reason, I don't ever try to peel the onion to understand because I never want to go too intrusive, but they're, you know, they'll talk about a child or a kid that they have and they haven't seen for 10 years or 12 years or whatever. And I'm just like, I don't understand, man. Like it's tough, right? Like I leave for a week for a business trip and it's like shedding on my heartstrings. I think overall, you're even seeing that in the society, you are starting to see, hey, changing bathrooms, right? Like you and I had daughters. Like, you know, I want to take my daughter into a bathroom. I need to be able to change her because like I took her to the playground just as much as her mom. And so, you know, she has to go to the bathroom. My wife's not there. I need to be able to change her diaper. Sometimes there's a third bathroom, which is fantastic, where I can take my daughter because, you know, she's at the age now that you don't really want to take her into the men's room, right? Like, you know, it just doesn't work like that. And so it's always been a little bit interesting. And it's funny, even with that, when I do things like that, like if I'm taking my daughter into a bathroom, it's always interesting because I feel like there's eyes on me.
Yeah, you're right. It's different now that I have my son, but my daughter Genevieve was young, like, you know, under two, before we left to go to Florida. I used to have that a lot in D.C. and the Virginia area. But now that I have my son, we're typically, you know, all out together. They figure out, oh, that's the dad with his family and stuff. Which I'll say this, there's another side to this in that I feel as though in the work, I don't know if you feel this and correct me, you know, if you feel differently, but I feel as though we get some privileges being involved fathers within corporate America and sometimes with our jobs that I think women don't necessarily get. And I say that in a sense that I feel like sometimes if a mom is taking care of her dudes, like let's say a mom, it's almost like a collective eye roll. Oh, man, we got to put up with this. Whereas a dad, he does that. It's almost like he's looked at as noble. Right. Now, often guys don't do that because for whatever reason, those type of duties typically are deferred to the women and the moms, maybe because they volunteer. Maybe they're just better. But I feel as though our society is a little bit more lenient toward men being active fathers and so forth. Like for me, I work from home a lot. Prior to coronavirus, I was still working from home. And there were times I said, listen, guys, I can't do this call right now because I got to pick up my kids. And first, it was a little uncomfortable telling clients that or telling coworkers that. But now everyone totally understands and they feel totally, terrible. If they feel like they're in violation of pride of family time and so forth. And I feel like women often don't get that sort of same privilege in our society. That's just my sense of it. What do you think?
I've always, it may be because of the way we've been standing up the dad corps, but I've always been really hyper focused on, that whole parental leave and looking at it as, are you the primary or secondary caregiver? And I get so offended by that one, man. I don't get offended by a whole lot in this world, but that one, what do you mean? So my wife is the one that does most of the taking care of, I guess, in the sense of like making sure Lon has school or made it to school because she has a little bit more of a flexible schedule. But that doesn't mean I'm secondary. Yeah. Like there's no, why are we calling one primary and one secondary? Like where did that language even come from? But then to your point, I think that's a very accurate and fair description because you see it, right? Like women are being held back for promotion because maybe they're spending time with their family as they should. I think we lose a lot of talent because of that in this world. If you just look at, and I'm very hypersensitive to it because I myself and like yourself are very involved in our kids' lives. I don't set meetings up at 8 a.m. I don't try to pick our team get-togethers for a late night dinner because I know, hey, I love my team, but I want to get home and see my kids. I assume the rest of the people, including the mothers. And so, I know that there was quite a bit of communication coming from JP Morgan Chase with Jamie Dimon, which I thought was really fantastic. He said, listen, like we've got to change the structure. You shouldn't be doing golf outings in the evenings. You shouldn't really be doing the dinners. You shouldn't have these early meetings. And he wasn't saying in the sense that they're bad. He's saying like, hey, you're right off the bat setting a stage that's unfair for people that are, whether you're a man or a woman, but it tends to be a mother.
Absolutely. Whereas a guy, like how many meetings have we said, no, I can't because I got to go pick up my daughter or take my, I think it's changing now, but I think historically, like 20 years ago, you wouldn't have seen that. A man would have said, honey, I need you to take care of the kids so I can go do this. Mm-hmm. So she sacrifices some parts of her career to rear the children. And I think another thing is that I think men in general, I think that to employers and in the corporate world in general, I think we're looked at as more responsible if we're active fathers. I think that there's like a level of trust. Like I know when I'm speaking to a potential client or prospect and so forth, and it's like small talk when your first introduction, I have kids, da, 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 and they just love hearing that because for them, it's almost, and sometimes I don't, whereas like women say it, it's almost neutral. It's almost like, okay, you're a woman, I expected that.
Because it's unexpected, you get bonus points for doing something that should be expected, right? It's the craziest thing, man. It is bonkers. I agree. There's definitely a focus on both, and I think there needs to be. And one of the things that I hope comes out of this coronavirus, I've talked to a number of business leaders out there, and they talked about what's the new normal look like, and everybody's had to work from home, and so you're juggling your kids being in school, and so you're hearing more babies in the background of conference calls. You're hearing people having to juggle or manage time differently. Like sometimes they can't take a call in the middle of the day when your typical business hours would be. And people are really understanding. And I think what's happened also for me is I see a level of authenticity coming to the conversation, right? Like, let's not pretend our families aren't the number one most important things in our lives and that we're all business all the time because we're not. And so it's great when I'm on the call and I hear a baby in the background. I love it, right? Hey, me too. I'm going through this, right? And so I hope that what one of the positive things that comes out of this is that people are more authentic and have higher empathy for each other around like just managing the daily life and the challenges that we have and really where the priorities should be, which is making sure your family's safe first. And then business is always business, but we can also be business and know that we're.
Yeah. And if anything comes out of this whole coronavirus pandemic / quarantine, I hope that's one thing that comes out of this is that we reemphasize family, what comes first, and more. And to your point, I like what you said, more authenticity.
I have a couple things for you. I have one, we've got the rapid fire questions. We've got a guest host that's going to be coming over here in a couple of minutes, my daughter. So she's going to give you some curveballs. I think you're pretty warmed up. And then after Milan comes through, I want to hit a couple of the deep questions. I know we've already started to go down there, but I want to ask you some pointed questions about your philosophies, insights, and perspectives around being a father, what it means to you, what you've taken from it. So does that sound like a fair way for us to go through the remaining format? Let's do it. So you have a special friend of Daddy's that's on here, and we knew him before you were born. His name's Mr. Spencer. You want to say hi?
Hi, Ms. Milan. Pleasure.
And so Mr. Spencer's ready for your curveball questions. So what would you like to ask?
What's your favorite animal?
Ooh. Oh, my gosh. I don't have a... That is a curveball question. I don't think I ever thought of one. Would it be cliche if I said tiger?
Yeah, it tiger. What's your favorite superhero? You can choose how many superheroes.
I would have to say, because Batman is a regular guy. Well, he's really wealthy, but other than that, he wasn't born with superpowers. And he had an agenda. He wants to do right. He believes in justice. I like Batman.
What's your favorite thing to do with your kids?
Well, I have my 5-year-old son in the background saying play basketball. So I think that's what I would have to say.
Does your son beat you?
No, he can't beat me yet. He's too young. He's only 5.
What's your favorite color?
Blue. I like blue. It's very calming.
What's your favorite thing that you did really fun as a dad?
That's a favorite thing. It is. It's her name is Milan. Now my kids have invaded my favorite thing that I've done as a dad would be, obviously they want me to say playing with them, but that just sounds so pedestrian. I would have to say just going to all of their events and shows, their recitals at the end of the year, their performances, because I know they study and practice really hard for those, and just being there and watching that, I just love to see that their hard work pay off.
What's the scariest you did?
First of all, I hate roller coasters, so any roller coaster, I'm not afraid of, like, I'm not afraid of the boogeyman or anything. I hate roller coasters. I just can't stand them.
Let me tell you something. I ride a roller coaster before with
my dad. I know.
See,
you are braver than me.
Yeah, I'm really brave. What's your favorite flower?
Is an orchid a flower or is that a plant? I'm not sure. I like lilies.
The flower is lilies. I thought a girl named Lily.
I love the smell of lilies. Yeah.
Yeah, they're so beautiful. What's your favorite sport?
I would have to say I grew up playing baseball, but I don't think it's my favorite sport anymore. I would probably say football. I know that's not a politically correct answer anymore because all the CTE. Yeah, but I'd probably say football.
What's your favorite food?
I'm getting a lot of influence from my background. I'm going to say lamb chops. That's also my daughter's favorite food. She's really excited about that. She loves that when I make lamb.
What's your favorite picture from your daughter?
We have a picture in Disney World where my son was turning 5. We were all mad. It was just a nice impromptu photo, and we have a nice big blown up at the house. That's probably my favorite photo.
Well, Milan, we're going to go to the next set of questions. Did you thank Mr. Spencer for joining the show and being a good sport through your rapid fire questions?
Thanks. Yep. I have one more question. What's your favorite drink?
So I need to ask your dad. Are we talking regular drinks or are we talking about adult beverages, Dad?
I think one of each would be sufficient.
Regular drinks, I'm going to take kombucha. I don't know. I love kombucha, man. That's my thing.
Awesome.
Anybody who knows me knows I'm like a kombucha evangelist. Anyways, kombucha. I was like one of the early adopters on kombucha. I'm talking like 2004, 2003 when nobody was on it. And then as far as adult beverages, I'm a big mezcal fan.
Mezcal is good. I started drinking tequila with instant coffee. But I'll tell you more on that one in a second. So
thank you,
Spencer.
Thank you,
Spencer.
Give me a kiss. I love you. All right. Good night, kiddo. So, man, let me tell you about a way to drink tequila. How you usually do a shot of tequila and you have your salt and your lemon or your lime. Well, and the sugar, right? Well, have the sugar, have the lime, but instead of having salt, dip sugar in with a little bit of instant coffee, and then you finish the shot with that on the lime, and that changes the game. Two reasons. One, because we're always tired, and so you want to wake up, you get a little bit of caffeine. But my goodness, you know, that mixed with a little bit of
so dry instant coffee, right? Fun that night. So swap that out. Swap the salt out with that.
Yep. And take your lime, dip it in a little bit of sugar, dip it in a little bit of that instant coffee, and then do your shot. And you just get a nice run through the couple hours, and the alcohol makes you feel good. The coffee gives you the caffeine. It's almost like a good Red Bull and vodka, except for you don't have the craziness that the Red Bull can bring for you, or the heartbeat, you know, the anxiety. Yeah, man. Try it out. So cool. All right. Well, hey, thanks for being a good sport through rapid fire with Milan. And now we can get into the heart of this podcast. Anything goes, whatever comes to your mind. But we really want to like open up and really share, you know, the kind of perspectives and philosophies and what you do on a tactical level to manage having such a beautiful family, a successful career, your entrepreneurial activities, as well as also being, you know, one of the most fit dads out there, especially, man, like you're making us all look bad. So you've raised a bar, which is amazing. So it's so great. But we're really looking for people to walk away and just really know who you are and then how you've looked at it. Because I've used some of the discussions we had, which you probably don't even realize when you're going through having a baby, for inspiration. And so, you know, I think you have a lot to share, and it's a great story. So without further ado, you know, the number one question that we always start out with is, what does being a dad mean to you, and how has it changed your life?
Being a dad for me means that there is someone I will always be accountable to and responsible for. That I cannot just, the days of just waking up in the morning and saying, well, what am I going to do with my life, or what am I going to do today? It's no longer relevant. I have to now think about these other lives. And that's what, to me, being a dad is. So they always talk about natural born leadership and so forth. And some of us aren't and so forth. But you really have to be a leader. You have to do what is isn't necessarily easy, but in the best interest of your children at all times, whether it be your activities, their activities, balancing that all out. So that's what being a dad is. And really, to be honest with you, I think that for new dads in particular, don't worry about being perfect. The thing about this is, even if you had a great example, like I had examples myself, like my granddad and my father and so forth, or even if I didn't have fathers like yourself, as you're going to learn along the way. Your children will learn, and you'll learn along the way. It's a learning process. No one comes in with all the answers. Just try your best. That's all you can. Just try your best. Give all your heart and soul. Don't be afraid to apologize. Don't be afraid to listen. I think that a lot of things that I think these new parents, I think this new generation, like our parents, you know, I don't know, they never apologized. They said whatever they said was edict. It was the law. And that was it. There was no listening. Don't be afraid to apologize. Don't be afraid to listen, particularly now. And these, you know, our kids are becoming teenagers and stuff. There's social media, which we didn't have growing up. It's really important, because if you don't listen, they can have whole separate, you know, friends and lives that you don't even know about that they can hide from you through all this new technology. So it's really important that you adapt with the times. You don't stay stubborn. You're dynamic, and you know, just be flexible. And don't beat yourself up. None of us are perfect.
That's a fantastic answer, man. And you know, it's interesting. You said something that hasn't come out on any of the other interviews, and we've done almost 10 of these things now. And that was, don't be afraid to apologize and really focus on, you know, listening, because I find myself, you know, making mistakes all the time. And even in front, my wife and I, or if we're having a bad day, or you're just on edge because of work, you can react a certain way if your child's doing something that you've asked them 100 times not to do. And then you react like that, and you realize that that is not the example. Like you don't want them to react. We're already telling them all the time, like, you know, calm, breathe, be patient, don't raise your voice. But then you raise your voice, right? And it's a confusing message. And so one of the things I found powerful powerful is like after those situations, like you said, you're never going to be perfect. It's okay to make mistakes, is to actually own a mistake and say, listen, like, you know, I lost my patience and I raised my voice and I shouldn't have done that. And I want to apologize to you. You deserve that because, you know, we expect the same as of you as we should expect.
Yeah, that's
of
so important.
I think that's
it shows your humanity. It goes back to what we were saying about work and being authentic, because you have to be authentic to your children. There are going to be times, yesterday I was having a tough day at work and I was really short tempered with my kids. You know, everybody's home, everyone's so pent up and so forth. The kids, they wanted me to take them out bike riding and I just simply couldn't. I was just stuck on calls. And, you know, but my daughter, every 5 minutes, can we go now, Dad? Can we go now? And, you know, I snapped on her, but after, she didn't deserve it. She didn't know the stress I was going through. But afterwards, I apologized to her and I said, I thank you. I took them out to dinner. Well, not dinner, but went out to get food and come back home because you can't really eat anywhere. But and they understood. So I think apologizing and owning up to your mistakes is really important as a parent.
And I've went through that a million times through this, you know, this coronavirus. I feel like it's a couple times a day. You know, you're busy, you've got calls, you've got stress, and you know, they're coming in and they just want to spend time with you. Like our kids are at that age where we are the hero, right? And so the more time, the better. And they don't always understand that we have to work and we have a lot of other things going on. And so then you react and I can just see and then I go think, wow, like let me put myself in her launch shoes. Her father just rejected her in her eyes, right? So then I have to go and say, listen, kiddo, like I'm not trying to reject you either. Like, you know, daddy has a lot of things going on. He's trying to work. And so, you know, just becoming a better communicator on why you're doing something, or if you made a mistake, why you made that mistake and why you're sorry. You can see it in their eyes, man. They just appreciate it. And you can see
it. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, another thing, I'll touch this point off and say it helps them because they go through things too. I know I have a son, my youngest son goes through temper tantrums. He has these little fits. And I always tell them, just relax, breathe in, breathe out. And if I fly off the handle, what example am I to him? So if I tell him to, if he's getting into it with his sister, apologize to his sister. If I can't ever apologize, how am I able to show him an example?
100%. 100%. There's a pretty interesting meme out there running around the internet that said that, you know, why do we expect our kids to never have a bad day, but we have bad days all the time, right? And it's true. You know, you do as a parent never really expect your kid to throw a temper tantrum. You never expect your kid to miss a shot or have a bad day at school. But yet we have bad days. Man, I have bad days most days, you know? So the difference in expectations of our kids versus ourselves. And when you start to take a light of that and look at it in that perspective, I think it really creates an empathy and an understanding. And so moving on into that, you know, transition, what have you taken from fatherhood and applied to your career?
Before I became a dad, I was probably a lot more flighty, meaning if I didn't like a job or I felt my boss was just sucked, or if I didn't like anything, I was just, okay, I'm gone. I'm bounced. I'm level of commitment. Now I would say I'm a lot more steady because I'm much more risk averse, right? Because circling back to point number one, knowing that you have these lives that you're responsible for, even if your boss is driving you up the wall or let's say you hate your job, but that's not the case for me. I absolutely love my job, but whatever the case might be, in the past, there've certainly been companies that I worked for and jobs I hated, and I would just absolutely bounce. But if I knew that I had children that I had to take care of and responsibilities, I would have certainly second guessed that. Why I think that's important is because, not because I don't think you should ever leave or not take risks or anything like that, but they're good. Like you said, there are good days and there's bad days. And what happens is sometimes we make these rash decisions off of one bad moment or one bad day or one bad incident, and we don't think about the ramifications. Now I calculate all of the ramifications of almost every decision that I make. So I'm a lot more calculating in my decision making. My decision making abilities has gone through the roof. That's one of the byproducts of being a dad for me.
Whenever I was single, when I was in my 20s, I would talk to my mentors and they would say, hey, when you have kids, you get more focused in and you're getting to what needs to be done and you're making the decisions with stability. And I never understood that. But what you just said is so true. Like it really, like when you have kids, your career, the way you approach it, becomes so much different, and it's really focused on building versus having some fun or trying something. Like, you realize, listen, this is what's feeding, I'll use your words from, you know, years ago, is this is what puts food on the table for my family. And so when you look at it that way, man, there's not a, let's see how this works out. If I don't like it, I'll just go to something else. There's a different level of responsibility.
And so when you're looking at that perspective, you know, what have you taken, you know, from everything you've done in your life, man? You've had such an interesting life and journey, and you're also, you went down this new path of bodybuilding. So fitness training and the dedication it's went through that and your career and overall.
It goes back to what I was saying about doing the bodybuilding competition and just being your kid's hero and showing to do a bodybuilding competition or anything, do anything great, or any accomplishment, you have to have discipline. And I think that one of the things that we as parents are constantly trying to instill in our children is discipline, right? Is, you know, every kid wants to, when they get out of school, go play, right? Go on the playground or go outside or watch TV, do whatever they want to do because they've been in school all day. But then you tell them, first you got to do your homework. Then you let them know, if you do your homework, you have more time to play. But if you don't do your homework, then all of a sudden you're grounded, you won't be able to go out, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to put things in perspective. So, and it's one thing to tell them, but it's another thing to lead by example. And so when I was doing the competition, my son, even though he's only like five, he constantly saw me, and even my 14-year-old, he was down here for the summer. I would say certain things to my 14-year-old. I would never say to my 5-year-old, but now I see my 5-year-old, he wants to get up and do push-ups in the morning, and he's flexing his muscles and stuff. I never pushed him to do any of that stuff, but he figures that's the healthy thing to do. That's the right thing to do. And the same thing for my 14-year-old. Now he wants to go out and train, hit the sled and push, you know. So it's about not just doing what I say, but doing what I do. So if I can be a positive example, it's one thing to say something, but if you live it, it's so much more powerful.
That's got to be a great feeling. I know when I do certain exercises, I see Milan trying to imitate, man. What'd that feel like? Because you went down this path and the dedication you had to do to get there, and you were successful with it. It must be a good feeling, though, and just a validation that you did the right thing of trying something new and really going for it. When you see your kids reacting that way, that might be even better than the feeling of actually
having the results. It absolutely is. I got a couple photos with the family after the show, with my trophies and so forth and the smiles on their faces. So it absolutely is that it's an amazing feeling. It's funny. I can get all the promotions at work and anything at work, but my kids, because I work at home, they don't think I have a job. They think I'm a bum on the computer all day. You know, even my 14-year-old, I was explaining to them, no, I'm at work. I'm doing work. They're like, you're not at work. Because they think of work as this place where you get up and you go, you put on a suit or whatever you do. You come home, but they're like, oh, daddy doesn't work, you know? So no matter what I do and, you know, however promotions I get, or if I started a company that was highly successful, that would nowhere have the impression on them as what I did in the bodybuilding competition, because they saw it. They saw the fruits of the labor. When I go out and the people, oh, look at the muscles and all that stuff, they see it. It's tangible. They can feel it. They sense it. They have no clue. And just no matter what I can do with my job and my career, day job, so to speak, that's going to give them same level of pride as when I stepped on that stage in the bodybuilding competition, because it's something that, A, it's number one, it's sexier. That's number one. My 14-year-old still wants me to quit my job and forsake everything that I work for and what I do to become a professional bodybuilder. I'm trying to explain to him, sir, I'm 40 years old. There's no career for me in this. But for him, he wants something that he can go tell his friends, hey, this is what my dad does. So
it's fascinating what you said about looking at the picture and seeing the smile on your kid's face. And I was just interviewing a friend of mine who is a private equity guy, and he's been having a super successful career in that area. And we're talking a little bit about what it's like to be a dad from the perspective of, you know, wanting people to be proud of you. And when I say people, your family. And when we do things, sometimes it's, hey, you're not present because you might be thinking about work, or you need to focus on the family more. And one of the things that we were talking about, one of the points that we made
was that from a dad's perspective, to your point, once you have your children, everything really becomes revolved around building your family and making sure your kids are successful and have a platform. And so when we go to work every day and every minute, we're not, you know, disengaged from family. We're actually completely engaged in our family because that's what we're doing, what we're doing. That's why we're committed to that action. When we're doing things, we're often trying to do them in a way that helps our family. And so when we're at home, if we're answering an email when we should probably be, you know, spending some face-to-face time, it's not because we're disengaged. It's actually like our view is that, you know, everything we're doing is for our family. And so really, you know, one of the things that we find is that dads overall, you know, I think are kind of underappreciated, or maybe not even underappreciated. We feel underappreciated at times. And so,
it's hard to explain to folks who, you know, don't have kids or fathers to be, but now that you're there, you get it.
I'm tired. I'm stressed. I'm, you know, just beaten down, but it's the best thing in the world. And that doesn't make sense. Like, that is just not a logical statement, but it is exactly like that, right? Like, it's challenges every single day. You use the word grind, but you also just get a sense of like pride that just is a different level, yep, which is amazing. And moving into a couple of the bigger questions from, you know, looking at the impact you've had and, you know, from being a parent into your career. How do you balance this, man?
Like, first, I have to give credit to my partner, my wife, Valerie. I'm James Worthy. She's Maggie Johnson, right? She's pitching and distributing. She's setting the table up for me to be successful as a dad, because it really is a partnership. But on a personal level, I would say having that discipline and structure, going to the gym, having outlets. I really, to be honest with you, I don't really go out a lot. I don't have a lot of guy friends or anything like that. I don't have, like, a poker night or anything like that. I literally just work and go to the gym. Literally, that's it. I don't have many outlets. Every now and then I'll catch up with the boys or something like that. But I'm pretty disciplined in that regard. So if I'm not working, I'm either working on another project, something that I'm trying to create, or, you know, doing something with my kids, or going to the gym, and the whole family's at the gym and incorporate them. That's like the best of both worlds, to be honest with you. So that's really, for me, that's how I juggle it. But it wouldn't be possible without my wife and partner, Valerie, because she's in healthcare. So she works a schedule that's sort of opposite of mine. So it allows her to be at a lot of the like dance practices or karate or soccer. Like if I can't pick the kids up, she's able to do it. Or the times when she's getting off work early in the morning and she's tired, she's still able to drop the kids off or to wake up early and then pick them up if I have a call in the afternoon. So I think having a good partner is, so even before the kids are here, and I think you can attest to this, having a good partner is tremendously important.
Right. And, you know, making sure that person fills in on where you're weak and vice versa. They really do say opposites attract, and having a little bit of that is never a bad thing. That was awesome. When you look at all that, tell me about the key principles you want to instill in your kids. And so we start calling these like next two questions, like the legacy questions. You know, what are the key principles you want to instill in your kids, and what type of traditions are important?
Knowing their history, knowing their culture. My kids are, their mom is Haitian, of Haitian descent by way of Canada. So she's a native French speaker, but also in the culture of Haiti. So knowing their culture is really important to me. History, just knowing history in general, having a sense of the arts, because I feel as though that's really being devalued in schools nowadays. So like my dad, one of the things that my dad imparted on me was my dad was sort of like a cinephile and also a big jazz historian. And a lot of that stuff when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, that went in one ear, went out the other. But what I realized is that it was noise, but I was listening. I may not have been an active listener. I may not have agreed or any of the other stuff, but I was listening, and it impressed upon me. So I want to impress upon them having a good sense of themselves, sense of pride, a sense of history, a sense of culture, knowing how to be self-sufficient, knowing how to cook, knowing how to take care of themselves, knowing how to clean. Obviously, having a good relationship with God. I'm not going to force any particular religion on them. I want them to find themselves. My belief is my belief, but I want them to be critical thinkers. I want them to always be, skeptical of any information out there and do their own research. But it all comes, for me, it all comes back to their sense of self, knowing who they are and having a sense of pride in who they are. That's the one thing I want my kids to sort of lead with, being critical thinkers.
And that's a sense of pride and knowing who they are and their culture and background, I think, is just something that I've heard others say, and I think it's so important. And the sense of pride is really the confidence to go out and achieve things, because, man, there's enough people out there that are going to try to knock that pride down every day, right? It's a tough world out there, and there's enough negativity that's always constantly trying to keep you from achieving your dreams. And so having that self-confidence and being able to do something is critical. When you think about that, tell me what you do tactically. If a dad's out there listening to this, one of the things that I always try to peel the onion on is, that is perfect. And that's exactly a 101 foundation that you want to build in your kids. But what do you do to do that on a daily basis? And what are some of the tips and tricks you've found effective in building your children's
confidence? Well, I think that for my kids is, it's having those sort of outside activities is really important. I think that athletics, for me growing up, athletics was a huge con. You play football. I played football, I played baseball and basketball. So athletics was a huge part of building confidence and so forth. For whatever, like my daughter, she's into gymnastics. My son, he's pretty much good in all sports, soccer and basketball. My oldest son, he's really good in soccer, played, junior Red Bulls and so forth. He wants to get into football now. And the reason why I think athletics is important is because it teaches them how to persevere and push through. Right. There's going to be pain. They go to when they're in the Pee Wee Leagues. Right. When they're like 5 or 6, they get knocked down. I don't know if you've seen those games. They always pout. And they're like, somebody knocked me down. And that's the first thing you get to. OK, well, just get back up. Keep working. Keep running. Or if they miss a shot, they get upset because they missed a shot. OK, well, there's more shots. You got to have that not to be cliche. You got to have that Mamba mentality. You got to keep firing, man. You got to keep going. And to me, it's applicable in life. Right. Like, you just don't like I cut my teeth in my professional world, like in sales. And we learned that, like, for every no, it's just getting us closer to a yes. But that mentality was sort of instilled to me in youth athletics. Right. You keep fighting. You keep persevering no matter what the odds are, no matter what the obstacle, no matter how tired you are. You keep fighting. You keep pushing. So for me, I want my kids to be involved in athletics, not because I want them to go professional or anything like that, or simply because I want them to take those lessons of perseverance and push through that they can apply to school, they can apply to their careers later on.
And when you talk about that perseverance through the athletics, let me ask you a question. I'm really curious on, as you're trying to build the self-confidence and the pride, but also the perseverance, what's your view on this whole participation awards?
My son, my 5-year-old, he plays like youth soccer and basketball at that age, so that everyone gets it. I get it, because that's sort of like the introduction. And so you don't want to have kids feel left out. But as they start to get older, when they start to get 10, 11, 12, and you can start to see a differentiation in the different skill levels. And at that point, I think it's really important that we don't necessarily hand out participation trophies and you reward successful behavior. But here's the thing. Here's the caveat. I don't think we should push like winning is everything at that age as well. Right. I think that's the other thing. So I think that it's okay to lose. When you're in youth athletics, I think you just need to participate. You just need to go out there. I don't think it's all about, winning championships and being the best. You just need to try, because everyone peaks at a different time period. Right. That famous story about Michael Jordan getting cut on the high school basketball team. I mean, everyone peaks at different time periods. The key is you want to keep trying.
What makes me curious and what's interesting is, you made a comment earlier around questioning things, right? And I think as we grew up, a lot of times, you said it, like your parents always came like they were never wrong. And so you weren't really given a platform to always question, but some of us did anyway. And so I look and I always try to question, do I feel a certain way just because that's the way I was brought up, or that's what I learned was the right way and the only way? Or do I feel like that because I've done my thoughtfulness, and my reflection through it? And when you look at something like participation trophies, I find it such a fascinating discussion, because you have this age where you have a lot of people saying kids should not get participation trophies. Kids need to show that, you know, if they put in the work, they're going to get the outcome and they're going to win. And, you know, and that's the reward that they get and the incentive. But yet, look at adults.
You're right.
We all get it.
You're absolutely right.
Look at CrossFit board. The CrossFit board isn't about winning. It's about getting your own PR, right? Like, it's about the participation and the effort. And so it's funny that us adults are the same ones saying you don't get a participation trophy. We're giving ourselves the participation trophies. Look at the corporate America. You get a thank you for your effort. You get cards. You get everybody gets a bonus at the end of the year. Thanks for participating in the last 2,000 hours for the year, right? Like, it's not, sometimes your bonus is tied to outcome, but a lot of people expect a bonus regardless of how the company performs. And so I find that whole kind of argument fascinating. And then, the one thing you notice when you look at people talk about participation trophies, the people that are talking about it are the people like maybe you're myself or yourself or others that have been successful in athletics. And so we feel, yeah, we put a lot of hard work in, and that's why we were successful and we, you know, deserve the trophy versus somebody that maybe didn't start or their team didn't win. But if you look at that a little bit, I actually now look back and I'm like, the kids that weren't starting, the kids that never got to see a minute of play time, they're actually more perseverance and more have more resiliency than we did. And could you imagine if you didn't play, but yet you showed up to practice every single day, you went through the effort when you could have been doing 100 other things, but you don't get to play a minute. At least we got the recognition. We got to play the game. So I don't know. I see you can't just reward people if they're not putting in the effort. So there's a little bit of the effort you have to look at. But I think sometimes we focus too much, to your point, on the outcome of the win loss versus the journey, which I think is, you know, one of the points you
just... Yeah, no, I didn't say the point about the journey, but the journey, I don't know who said it, and, you know, but the journey is the destination. Absolutely. The journey is the destination. As I told you about some of my entrepreneurial endeavors, without a product or fruit in hand, It's a process. Same thing for bodybuilding. But I look back at the bodybuilding, all the stuff, the culmination on stage was the two-a-days or the throwing up in the trash can or the saying no to certain foods. And you realize, you look back and say, oh, that was it. That was why you did all this stuff. Getting on stage, you're just showing off but the whole process was what it was about. And you got to embrace that process. You're absolutely right. And so I think we should de-emphasize necessarily wins and losses. Unless you're a professional, where wins or losses are tied to something tangible and stuff like that, or maybe, you know, it's like college at the highest level or something, then to me it's a moot point. You know, it's just like, give your best. That's all you can ask for. Just try your best.
The real long-term benefits you gain is the teamwork, the commitment, the dedication, the perseverance. At the end of the day, you were Al Bundy and you scored 4 touchdowns in your high school game. Great, man. That was probably a fantastic day. I'm sure you had some cheerleaders you got the high five with. But come on, 15 years from now, your boss is not going to care, right? But what your boss is going to care about is that you're a leader because you learned how to motivate your teammates. You're a great team player because you learned how to play your role. You have grit because you've learned how to move through challenging events. And that's really what you carry through. And I think that's what we need to
wholeheartedly agree.
Reward. And so, Spencer, we got one final one, man, for you. And this is what we call the ode to dad. And I'll tell you a little bit about where the ode to dad came from. We always are trying to think about what's that final question around, if you had to write what your kids would say to you, you know, or say about you one day when they're talking about you, what would you want that to be? And it turns out, like, one of our guests is quite a rhymer and author. And so he authored this book around cooking and it rhymed. And so he actually started to create an ode for himself instead. And I was like, man, that's great. So I won't ask you to go to that extent, but, you know, if your kids were going to start writing a song or an ode to you in a speech, you know, what would be the key parts that you would want them to write?
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a little heavy. I would have to say that the dad was passionate, that, you know, the dad cared. Dad was there. He was passionate. He was present. That dad loved our mother. That's a big one for me. I know all relationships don't necessarily work out. but then I was always respectful. And I think that's important going into their future relationships. But the dad was consistent. That the dad was a man of his word.
Man, I love it. I love it. I have nothing to even respond to that. That'll be a fantastic statement. So I know I put you on the spot on that one and you nailed it. So thank you for that. And Spencer, to finish up, why don't you tell people, if they were listening, where they can find you, what you have going on out there publicly, that they can follow you?
I'm the number one Black Radiohead fan in the world. It's the greatest band ever. So I'm a Radiohead evangelist. So that's my thing. So you can find me on IG and Twitter at Black Radiohead. That's where you can find me. Always interesting takes, no hold back. I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but I'm definitely someone's shot of Hennessy. So that's where you can find me.
That's awesome. Hey, and thank you. It's so great to connect with you again. You know, I loved your family. Can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know it's a big commitment to 2 hours when you have family time and everything else going on, but you know, really appreciate it. Glad we reconnected. Let's get the kids on a video chat and let's keep
in touch. Sounds like a plan, brother.
You know. All right, buddy.